Imperial defense. The Empire's military effort is perhaps the most commonly derided aspect of its early modern existence. Most 19th and 20th century historians measured state effectiveness by martial prowess. The Empire's apparent incapacity is usually illustrated by its mobilization against Prussia during the Seven Years' War. At the Battle of Rossbach on the 5th of November 1757, Frederick the Great crushed a much larger combined Franco-Imperial army, inflicting losses of 5,000 compared to 548 of his own troops. The rout and subsequent disintegration of the Imperial Army, Reichsarmee, led to its being mocked as the Runaway Army, Reichsausarmee. In fact, Imperial troops made up only one quarter of the combined army, and a third of them were actually the Austrian contingent. The causes of the defeat were multiple and cannot be attributed simply to any supposed deficiencies of the Empire. The Empire as a whole never possessed a permanent army, but instead, imperial reform created a mechanism to mobilize troops when required for collective defense and internal peace enforcement. Burdens were apportioned between the imperial estates using the matricular quota system. Legislation issued between 1495 and 1555 established the process by which mobilization could be authorized by the Reichstag for the entire empire, or by the Kreisassemblies for their own regions. Further adjustments in 1570 rejected tentative moves across the previous decade towards funding a permanent cadre in peacetime. The accumulative effect of these measures was to link official military activity firmly to upholding the eternal public peace. This associated military authority, Militärhoheit, with the imperial estates, since these had been charged since 1495 with maintaining the peace, thus denying such powers to mediate lords and communities whose martial activities came under growing supervision from the territorial authorities. Imperial estates were identified with powers of command, able to name officers for their own forces, just as they had led forces in person under the previous, more personal feudal obligations. Nominal supreme command remained reserved for the emperor, but in practice, he named several generals. From the mid-17th century, the emperor consulted the Reichstag when appointing commanders of common imperial forces, but retained exclusive control of his own Habsburg troops. Princes recruited for foreign powers, most famously Hessen-Kassel during the American Revolution, claiming this as a German freedom. But that activity remained formally restricted by the proviso that it should not harm the empire or emperor. Failure to observe this gave Joseph I an excuse to sequestrate Bavaria, Cologne, and Mantua during the War of the Spanish Succession. Except for financial support in 1544, the Empire refrained from backing Charles V's wars against France, compelling him to use his own forces and those he secured by appealing to individual princes. The large numbers of German mercenaries serving him in Italy and the Low Countries were paid for by his own revenues and borrowing. Formal collective action remained limited to policing the western frontiers, especially after 1562, to insulate Germany from the civil wars raging in France and the Netherlands. Measures agreed at Reichstags between 1555 and 1570 failed to prevent either side from recruiting German and Italian troops, but otherwise successfully prevented these conflicts spreading into the empire, except for Spanish and Dutch incursions in northwest Germany after 1585. Like taxation, the main military effort was directed eastwards at Turkish aid, reflecting the common expectation that the empire should remain at peace with Christians whilst fulfilling its duty to repel the Ottomans. Substantial contingents were dispatched five times from 1532, culminating in a sustained effort during the Long Turkish War ending in 1606. These were field forces raised for specific campaigns, augmenting troops from the Habsburg lands and much smaller numbers of volunteers from across Europe. Rudolf II opened the Long Turkish War in 1593 with a field army of around 12,000 men from his own lands and 8,000 to 10,000 from the Empire. The only permanent force comprised 20,000 garrison troops guarding the Hungarian frontier after the 1520s, as well as a gunboat flotilla on the Danube. Military organization at the territorial level conformed to the imperial structure. Princes and imperial cities maintained small guard units, primarily for status and public order. These provided a professional cadre for contingents sent against the Turks. Peasants were enrolled in territorial militias, legitimized by reference to imperial legislation, requiring princes to maintain public order and assist the empire. The militias underwent periodic reorganizations, especially from the 1570s, when more systematic drilling was introduced, but they remained comparatively ineffective. Major operations always required professionals, hence the significance of the empire's fiscal system to pay them. The Schmalkaldic League and other alliances formed during the 16th and early 17th centuries all borrowed directly from the empire's quota system in their own mobilization structures. The Habsburgs tried to fight the Thirty Years' War using these structures by claiming that the Bohemian Revolt was a breach of the public peace, while presenting Swedish intervention as a foreign invasion. Throughout, they legitimated their operations by issuing mandates summoning their opponents to lay down their arms and negotiate. Those who failed to respond were branded outlaws to be targeted with punitive action. Habsburg supporters like Bavaria conformed to this approach, since it legitimated their own seizure of lands and titles from the emperor's enemies. Initially, all belligerents tried to fund war from regular taxes, supplemented by foreign subsidies, forced loans, and coinage debasement, the latter causing rampant inflation between 1621 and 1623. Most of the emperor's early opponents were relatively minor princes who lacked either large territories or reliable foreign backers, and were forced to subsist by extorting money and supplies from the areas where their armies were operating. General Albrecht von Wallenstein's contribution system, adopted by the emperor's forces after 1625, attempted to regularize this and extended it on an unprecedented scale. Wallenstein hoped to win the war by awe rather than shock, assembling such overwhelming numbers that further fighting would become unnecessary. Drawing on imperial legislation since 1570, Wallenstein issued ordinances regulating what his troops could demand from local communities, thus entirely bypassing regular tax systems. Subsidies and taxes from the Habsburg lands were now reserved to buy military hardware and other items that could not be sourced locally, as well as servicing the loans on which the entire system increasingly depended. Wallenstein's system suffered from several major flaws, not least the excessively high pay rates he allowed his senior officers and the rudimentary checks on graft and corruption. The numerous abuses feature prominently in contemporary criticism and subsequent historical discussion, but it was their political implications that made his methods so controversial. Wallenstein's army tapped the empire's resources directly without reference to the Reichstag or the Kreis assemblies. He gave the emperor an army funded by the empire, but under Habsburg control, and used to wage what was really a highly contentious civil war. Whilst contributions sustained the ordinary soldiers, their officers expected larger rewards, not least because they generally raised and equipped their units at their own expense. Wallenstein was already a major beneficiary of the redistribution of property confiscated from Bohemian nobles in the wake of the imperial victory at White Mountain in 1620. Confiscations were rolled out across the rest of Germany following further victories from 1623, with Wallenstein receiving the Duchy of Mecklenburg in 1628, sequestrated from its dukes, who had unwisely backed Danish intervention 3 years before. Alarmed, the electors combined to force Ferdinand II to dismiss Wallenstein in 1630, reduce the army, and switch to regular imperial taxes that allowed greater scrutiny and control. Sweden's invasion of the empire prevented the full implementation of these changes and prompted Ferdinand to reinstate Wallenstein. Wallenstein failed to defeat the Swedes and was increasingly regarded as a liability in Ferdinand's efforts to persuade Sweden's German partners to defect. Wallenstein's judicial murder in February 1634 demonstrated that the emperor retained control over the army and the loyalty of most of its personnel, but the problem of organizing war remained. Temporary military ascendancy allowed Ferdinand to order all imperial estates to combine their own troops with his as a single imperial army funded by regular imperial taxes. This arrangement was enshrined in the Peace of Prague in 1635, but it failed because the prevailing conditions rendered its financial arrangements untenable. In practice, the emperor had to allow Bavaria, Saxony, Cologne, and, to an extent, Brandenburg, considerable military autonomy. France and Sweden evolved an effective strategy after 1641, successively targeting pro-imperial territories like Brandenburg and Bamberg until they agreed neutrality. This gradually reduced the areas supporting imperial troops, forcing them onto the defensive. Nonetheless, Ferdinand III and his German allies still mustered over 76,000 men in 1648, compared to the 84,000 of his opponents, a significant factor in the emperor's ability to extract reasonably favorable terms in the Peace of Westphalia. The overwhelming desire for peace after 1648 led to the disbandment of virtually all forces in the empire. Only the Habsburgs retained a small permanent army, which they redeployed in Hungary. However, the wider international situation compelled further discussion of defense. The emperor's preferred solution was to return to the late 16th century practice of extended Reichstag grants, subsidizing the cost of the Habsburgs' own army. This was politically unacceptable after the experience with Wallenstein. The electorates and several medium-sized principalities established their own permanent forces during the later 1650s and 1660s. The earlier militias were sometimes revived and adapted as a limited form of conscription, providing cheap recruits to augment the professionals. The outbreak of almost permanent warfare on the empire's western frontier after 1672 saw these forces expand considerably, creating the first true standing armies alongside that of the emperor. This forged a new divide in the empire between the armed estates, armierten Stände, and their unarmed neighbors. Leopold I relied heavily on the armed estates, who could supply troops fairly quickly during both the Turkish War of 1662-1664 and especially in the Dutch War of 1672-1679 to defend the Rhine against French attacks. Collective defense became a modified version of Wallenstein's system as Leopold assigned unarmed territories and cities to provide funds and supplies to support the troops of the armed estates. Unarmed territories now risked slipping into mediate status under powerful territories like Brandenburg, Saxony, Hanover, and the heavily armed bishopric of Munster, all of which tried to formalize their predominance by establishing protectorates. By 1679, it was obvious that the armed estates intended to deprive unarmed ones of the right to participate in the Reichstag and Kreis assemblies on the grounds they were no longer meeting their obligations to the empire directly. This threatened to federalize the empire through the mediatization of smaller territories, shortening the status hierarchy to a collection of large and medium-sized militarized principalities. Leopold realized this would undermine his ability to manage the empire, and he sided with the lesser imperial estates of the Reichstag to force through a compromise defense reform in 1681-1682, establishing a system of collective security lasting until 1806. The matricular quotas were revised more clearly on a regional basis, retaining the 1521 register for cash contributions, but assigning new manpower contingents to give a basic rate, simplum, totaling 12,000 cavalry and 28,000 infantry. As before, these could be mobilized as a fraction or multiple of the basic quota. The reform succeeded because it stabilized the status hierarchy without preventing any further change. The right as well as the duty of all estates to contribute was confirmed. The role of the Kreiser expanded to organize contingents from the smaller territories who could combine their soldiers into regiments of broadly uniform size. The smaller territories could still opt to pay cash in lieu, but the money was now to go through the Reichspfennigmeister, later the Imperial Operations Fund, to prevent them being bullied into unequal local arrangements by more powerful neighbors. All imperial estates were free to maintain additional troops above what they should provide for the empire, especially as such obligations were on a sliding scale with no theoretical upper limit. However, this did not amount to the law of the gun, Kanonenrecht, as some critics maintained, because in 1671, Leopold prevented the armed princes from securing the Reichstag sanction for unlimited war taxes. Consequently, the legal position remained the one agreed in 1654, that subjects were only obliged to pay for necessary fortresses and garrisons, thus still allowing some scope for territorial estates to decide what these amounted to, as well as for the emperor to intervene when they could not agree. The armed estates were also still free to provide additional auxiliaries through private arrangements with the emperor that might advance their dynastic goals. Finally, collective defense remained tied to the established constitutional framework governing decisions for war and peace, thus anchored on the ideal of a defensive war, since only this was likely to secure the necessary approval through the Reichstag. The collective structure was capable of substantial, sustained effort. Although the actual Kreis contingents, Kreistruppen, were always lower than the totals agreed by the Reichstag, it should be remembered that the Habsburgs always subsumed their own contribution within their own army, thus accounting for another 30% above the numbers supplied by the smaller territories. Many of the auxiliaries also included men serving in lieu of Kreis contingents, because many princes wanted to keep all their soldiers together in a single force to increase their weight within the grand coalitions against France. For example, such forces accounted for 28% of the auxiliaries provided during the War of the Spanish Succession. The continuous warfare saw the total number of soldiers maintained by the emperor and imperial estates rise from 192,000 in 1683 to peak at 343,300 in 1710. The most significant and surprising aspect of this rapid militarization was the disproportionate growth amongst the smaller territories, whose total strength grew by 95% to reach 170,000 men, compared to a 75% increase in the Prussian army to 43,500, and a 62% rise in Habsburg strength to 129,000. Thus, imperial defense imposed a heavy burden on the empire's weakest elements, but territories used the Kreis structure to organize their own contingents, enabling them after 1702 to break free from onerous arrangements imposed by Prussia, Saxony, and the Palatinate, which had previously provided troops to the imperial army on their behalf. In contrast to the almost universal disbandment in 1648, the Westphalian, Upper Rhenish, Electoral Rhenish, Swabian, Franconian, and Bavarian Kreiser, agreed in 1714 to remain armed in peacetime by maintaining contingents at 1.5 times the basic quota. Perhaps more surprising still is that militarization remained contained by a highly legalistic political culture, unlike, say, China in the 1920s, where warlords created their own provincial armies with little regard to the Republic's formal order. Despite their lands being the most heavily armed part of Europe, the German princes continued to submit their disputes to judicial arbitration through the imperial courts, rather than make war on their neighbors. The collective system mobilized 34,200 Kreis troops for the 1735 campaign during the War of the Polish Succession, 1733-1735, against France, while at least 112,000 recruits and auxiliaries were supplied to the Habsburg army across 1733-1739. The disappointing outcome of this campaign and the parallel Turkish War, 1736-1739, combined with political disillusionment with the Habsburgs and the disaster of Wittelsbach imperial rule between 1742 and 1745, to weaken collective defense. Most territories reduced their peacetime forces, and several withdrew from military cooperation at Kreis level. This trend was compounded by the underlying shift in the empire's internal military balance, as the combined strength of the Austrian and Prussian armies expanded from 185,000 men in 1740 to 692,700 50 years later, compared to the combined total of all other forces that dropped by around 9,000 men to 106,000 by 1790. As we shall find out, this growing military imbalance seriously threatened the empire's continued viability. Economic measures. The standard model of European history sees centralized monarchies as incubators of social and economic development. Royal capitals emerged as political, economic, and cultural hubs, concentrating wealth and fostering dynamic innovation. Royal authority helped spread uniform systems of law, coinage, tariffs, weights and measures, helping to integrate local and regional economic activity. Localities and groups lost local protection and were compelled to innovate in order to survive within larger market networks. Monarchies reduced the transaction costs of doing business by providing a safe environment under the rule of law. While there is certainly plenty of evidence supporting this interpretation, it does not mean that other kinds of political order were invariably inferior in fostering economic developments. For most of the empire's history, its most dynamic economic regions were those of the greatest political fragmentation, like Flanders, Brabant, and the Rhineland, rather than the larger territories, such as those of the north and east. The reasons are complex. A major factor was that the more productive areas were clustered along the major transport route of the Rhine and its tributaries. While this concentration of wealth facilitated a dense, more complex lordly hierarchy, the resulting political diversity did not inhibit further demographic and economic growth. The proximity of different authorities could also encourage innovation and experimentation, such as the founding of luxury goods manufacturing during the later 17th and 18th centuries. The real test was how far the empire could mitigate the constraining consequences of its internal structure, whilst not stifling the potentially innovative economic aspects. Economic coordination remained conventional throughout the Middle Ages. Like other monarchs, the emperor's main task was guaranteeing peace and justice for moral reasons, with any benefits for prosperity remaining secondary considerations. Direct intervention was restricted to what would now be termed investment incentives, privileging particular lords and communities through grants of market, mint, mining, and toll rights, all of which proved significant in promoting urban development. The number of settlements with market rights doubled to 90 across the 10th century, rising to 140 in the 11th century, and reaching 250 in the next. Politics shaped this as much as economics, since episcopal towns were the principal beneficiaries, reflecting the emperor's reliance on the imperial church. Only 25 mints were active in the empire before 1140, but the Staufer's use of regalia as rewards increased this number to 250 by 1197, of which only 28 were under royal control, while 106 were held by spiritual and 81 by lay lords. The total nearly doubled again to 456 by 1270, with the balance shifting to the secular lords, who now operated 277 mints, compared to 152 spiritual and 37 royal ones. This expansion was partly in response to the growing money economy and demand for small change, but largely reflects the shift from the Staufers to the little kings who bought support. It also underscores a point to be made in the following chapter, that the empire had a tangible impact on the lives of ordinary inhabitants. As we have heard, changes in vassalage from the 12th century contributed to commercialization by opening fiefs and jurisdictions to sale and mortgages. Royal privileges frequently contradicted each other. One charter might grant toll rights to one lord, whereas another exempted individuals or communities. Only trade fair rights followed a more coherent development. The Frankfurt Fair received special privileges in 1330, followed in 1466 by that of Leipzig, which received 15 more confirmations and extensions by 1770. The imperial charters guaranteed free trade by exempting merchants from tolls and providing special protection for themselves and their wares as they traveled to and from a fair. These competitive advantages enabled them to undercut other markets, in turn attracting further business to Frankfurt and Leipzig. The effective establishment of the eternal public peace by 1525 enabled the empire to deliver the promised security. The more sophisticated early modern legal culture brought additional benefits. For instance, Leipzig secured a Reichshofrat ruling against its own prince, the Elector of Saxony, who was promoting a rival trade fair in Naumburg. Leipzig and Frankfurt both secured injunctions to limit the development of Brunswick as an alternative venue. The two imperial trade fairs complemented each other. Leipzig mainly served the north and east, with links to the North Sea and Baltic, while Frankfurt was orientated south and west, with connections to Italy and the Mediterranean. Both serviced more regionally focused networks based around subsidiary fairs in other towns, thus providing an economic network mirroring the empire's political structure. Territorialization provided an additional layer of economic regulation and coordination from the 14th century, as authorities increasingly assumed the initiative within their jurisdictions and also issued privileges and exemptions. The Reformation added a heightened moral imperative, boosting existing efforts to regulate daily life through police measures. Imperial reform strengthened the empire's capacity to guarantee general peace and defuse socio-economic tensions. The Reichstag issued general normative legislation in the 16th century, providing guidelines that were adapted to local circumstances through incorporation in territorial law codes and regulations. This allowed for diversity of practice within a common system, enabling serious disputes to be resolved through the imperial courts. In this way, imperial institutions maintained a partially free market, encompassing a quarter of all Europeans around 1500. Most of the population was legally free to move, though some territories imposed restrictions, notably Brandenburg, Prussia, where in the 18th century, emigration was equated with military desertion. Charles V's dependency on South German and Italian bankers prompted him to oppose the anti-monopoly legislation promoted by electors and princes at the Reichstag after 1519. However, the Reichstag gradually dismantled the canon law prohibition on usury after 1530, extending 5% as the ceiling for all credit arrangements in 1654. Territorial authorities and local communities frequently borrowed at higher rates, but imperial law did curb excessive charges, since creditors could not use the courts to enforce them. The 1653-1654 Reichstag tackled the lack of credit following the 30 Years' War by giving all debtors a 3-year moratorium, whilst cutting interest arrears by 3/4. Special arrangements were made for the devastated Palatinate, which received a 10-year moratorium. These measures protected debtors, but upheld the integrity of the capital market by rejecting calls for repudiation of all liabilities. However, the system remained conservative. Although reduced, old obligations retained their validity and continued to burden future generations, in some cases, into the 19th century. Currency regulation provides a similar picture of partial success on its own terms, but at the cost of sustaining conservative practices. The Reichstag asserted loose overall supervision of mints by making currency debasement a capital offense in 1532 and issuing the Imperial Currency Ordinance, Reichsmünzordnung, in 1524 to regulate exchange rates by establishing an official relationship between the South German gold florin and the North German silver thaler. The two coins became official units of account to which all territorial currencies could be related according to their precious metal content. Politics hampered these arrangements from the start, since the northern territories felt that their currencies were undervalued. 3 revisions to the ordinance failed to solve this by 1571, because territories issued coins called florins and thalers, but containing varying quantities of precious metal. Regulation was devolved in 1566 to the Kreiser, which were considered to stand a better chance of managing the situation closer to the ground and to punish deviations from the rules. Maximilian II undermined collective efforts by unilaterally removing the Habsburg lands from the common framework in 1573, as part of the wider effort to insulate the dynasty's possessions from scrutiny by the imperial estates. However, the real problem was the conservative attitude to money. All levels of authority clung to the belief that wealth was finite and expressed through bullion. Yet precious metal was both a medium of exchange and an object itself, for example, for use in making jewelry. The cost of minting coins could rise above their face value, encouraging their debasement through mixing in inferior value metal. The regulations were devised before the spread of copper coins as small change in the later 16th century. Above all, official rates bore little relation to economic value defined through productivity. Meanwhile, the need for reliable exchange rates grew with the development of deposit banks in Amsterdam, 1609, Hamburg, 1619, and Nuremberg, 1621, which used imaginary units of account to facilitate international money transfers. The proliferation of mints during the High Middle Ages hindered control. The Reichstag tried in 1603 to limit their number to 3 or 4 per Kreis, but in Lower Saxony alone there were 30 in 1617, 12 of which were condemned by the Kreis currency meeting that year for breaching official rules. Debasement, or lowering the value of currency, appeared a quick fix to the pressing need to pay soldiers after 1618. The economically weaker belligerents resorted to this in 1619, followed by the Habsburgs 2 years later. The most notorious operator was the Prague Mint Consortium, composed of politically influential Habsburg officials, including Wallenstein, which issued 40 million florins of largely nominal coin in an operation considered by modern economists to be far worse than the quantitative easing by the European Central Bank in response to the 2008 Eurozone crisis, and precipitating what has been termed the Western world's first financial crash. Bread prices rose 400% in 1621 to 1622, triggering riots and military mutinies. Like the wider 30 Years' War, of which it was part, the financial crisis had been caused in part by deficiencies in the empire, yet that same structure helped resolve it. Imperial currency regulations provided a recognized framework for concerted action that worked, because most of those involved recognized that debasement was counterproductive. Imperial cities already acted in 1620, followed by more coordinated efforts through the Kreise in 1622 to 1623, that prompted territorial authorities to devalue their currencies by up to 90%, whilst recalling debased coins and reminting them at official rates. Most territories had returned to the silver standard by 1623, including for their small change, while copper coins were largely driven from the empire. The relatively successful outcome discouraged innovation, and the pre-war system remained in place, with territories issuing their own coinage and monitoring entrusted to the Kreise, guided by the existing imperial currency ordinances. Some lessons had been learned, and the resumption of prolonged warfare after 1672 saw swift action from the Kreise against the few territories attempting debasement. The Reichstag last adjusted exchange rates in 1738, but again official values did not match market rates, prompting Austria to devalue its own currency. Thereafter, Austro-Prussian rivalry hindered coordination, especially once Prussia followed Austria's example and devalued below the official rate in 1750. It then issued large quantities of debased coins to subsidize the cost of the Seven Years' War, 1756 to 1763, while Austria resorted to Central Europe's first paper money by issuing 12 million florins in coupons in 1761. Prussia revalued in 1764, but not to the official rate. With both German great powers outside the official exchange rate mechanism, Bavaria and others left after 1765, leading to the breakdown of cross-regional cooperation through the Kreise. The overall consequences were not too grave. The outcome was the end of efforts to fix rates permanently through imperial law, allowing currencies to fluctuate according to market values. The official legislation continued to offer opportunities to cooperate and to prosecute fraudsters. Toll and tariff regulation followed a similar course. Like mints, tolls and tariffs proliferated through royal charters to individual lords and towns, most of whom interpreted the terms fairly broadly to develop a range of income streams. Richard of Cornwall tried to reduce their number in 1269, while Rudolf I banned all unjust tolls 5 years later. By that point, numerous authorities possessed such rights without anyone, the emperor included, having universally recognized powers to revoke them. Tolls and tariffs continued to develop in response to locally changing circumstances and the growing need to raise cash rather than just labor and produce from inhabitants. The emergence of the Reichstag and Kreise provided a framework for more effective management at a time when many believed tolls were strangling trade. As part of his election agreement, Charles V promised not to grant further toll rights without the elector's consent, while the Reichstag added in 1576 that territories required their neighbor's consent before establishing new toll posts. Financial imperatives led to this being ignored, especially after 1618. Wartime tolls were formally abolished by the Peace of Westphalia, and the Peace Implementation Congress in Nuremberg charged the Kreiser with enforcing this. Action failed in some regions, like Lower Saxony and the Electoral Rhine, because no one wanted to be the first to lower tariffs. Elsewhere, leading territories set an example because they realized tolls were harming lucrative transit trade. Total abolition of internal tolls was rejected, and in 1658, Leopold confirmed the 1576 arrangements. Thereafter, central coordination was limited to official trade embargoes against France during the wars after 1672. A common toll and tariff policy was hindered throughout by the complexity of the empire's internal structure, not only within Germany, but between it and Burgundy and Italy. However, later Imperial Germany also lacked a uniform customs system before 1904, while internal tariffs were scarcely uncommon in pre-modern Europe. England's unified system was exceptional. France's internal toll stations employed 20,000 revenue officers who still treated Lorraine as a separate country after its formal annexation in 1766. The real problem lay not with imperial institutions, but how the larger territories embraced fashionable economic thought known as cameralism, which encouraged economic autarky. Local producers were to be protected by tariffs and promoted by state subsidies, while other measures attempted to shape social behavior and encourage greater thrift, piety, and obedience. Some aspects of cameralism advocated greater centralization at the territorial level. However, a major goal remained to preserve the corporate social order and resolve its problems. Thus, toll policy also reflected this. For example, only 5 of the 9 toll posts on the Elbe River in Bohemia were state-operated, with 3 run by municipalities and 1 controlled by nobles. Cameralist measures were frequently counterproductive, but they appeared to work better in larger territories, raising anxiety amongst their smaller neighbors that they were economically as well as politically disadvantaged. The Kreis structure offered opportunities for micro-territories to coordinate activities, especially because many economic issues directly affected public order. For example, the Swabian Kreis organized police sweeps against vagrants, control measures during epidemics, and price regulation in times of dearth. Its 1749 road ordinance allowed it to compel cooperation from landowners who were not Kreis members to help maintain highways across the region. Overall, imperial and Kreis coordination remained only partially effective, while the positive aspects of political diversity did not apply to all economic sectors. For example, cameralism intensified competition where territories in close proximity produced and sold similar goods. This could stimulate innovation, while fear of losing business might curb the desire to raise tariffs. However, many activities were largely fixed, like water transport, forestry, mining, and their associated capital equipment. For example, barges developed for one river trade could not necessarily be used to transport goods on another waterway. Much of the Rhine and Elbe trade relied on transporting heavy bulk goods, especially timber, which remained the main item in both quantity and value into the 1820s, but also iron ore, stone, and agricultural produce like grain, wine, fruit, hemp, and wool. All these items were unsuited for road transport, making it hard to use alternative routes to waterways. Consequently, by the 18th century, there were 32 toll stations on the Rhine and 35 on the Elbe, most of which were operated by different lords. Their owners had little incentive to reduce rates to boost trade because they already enjoyed a captive market. Tolls added nearly 60% to the cost of salt just traveling between Cologne and Frankfurt, while it was cheaper to take wine up the Main to Frankfurt and overland to Kassel for shipment down the Weser instead. It was precisely these kinds of problems that the imperial framework should have resolved by providing the forum to reach a mutually beneficial solution. Yet all talks failed because too few authorities were prepared to forego local advantages, and there was no mechanism to compel them. Only thanks to French pressure after 1795 were the Rhine toll stations reduced to 12 with published rates within a common system called the Octroi under Franco-German administration. Simultaneously, a start was at last made on dredging and straightening the river. The successor states retained the Octroi after 1815 until the last Rhine toll was abolished in 1868.